AC Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada Ki Jai. This can found your charity Sri Prabhupada.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 13, the Ahamsa Avatar Answers Questions, today's text 28.
Yarhi Sangshati Bandhoyam
Atmano Gunavrittida
Mai Turye Stito Chayat Chagastha Dunachetasam Yarhi Sangshati Bandhoyam Atmano Gunavrittida Mai Turye Stito Chayat Chagastha Dunachetasam Yarhi Sangshati Bandhoyam Atmano Gunavrittida Mai Turye Stito Chayat Chagastha Dunachetasam
Yarhi,
whereas,
Sangshruti,
of material intelligence or
material
existence,
Bandha,
bondage,
Ayam,
this is,
Atmana,
of the soul,
Guna,
in the modes of nature,
Vrittida,
that which gives occupations,
Mai,
in me,
Turye,
in the fourth element,
beyond wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep,
Stita,
being situated,
Jayat,
one should give up, Tyaga.
Renunciation.
Tat.
At that time.
Guna.
Of the material sense objects.
Chetasam.
And of the material mind.
Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada.
The spirit soul is trapped in the bondage of material intelligence, which awards him constant engagement in the illusory modes of nature. But I am the fourth stage of consciousness, beyond wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep. Becoming situated in me, the soul should give up the bondage of material consciousness. At that time, the living entity will automatically renounce the material sense objects and the material mind.
Purport.
Lord Krishna now specifically answers the questions that the sages originally placed before Lord Brahma. Ultimately, the spirit soul has nothing to do with material sense objects and modes of nature. But because of one's false identification with the material body, the modes of nature are empowered to engage one in illusory occupations. By destroying his false identification with matter, the soul gives up the illusory occupations awarded by the modes of nature. It is clearly stated in this verse that the living entity is not empowered to independently free himself from illusion, but must situate himself in Krishna consciousness, in full awareness of the Supreme Lord.
Om Gyanate Varandasha Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshulun Mitamina Tasma Shri Gurave Namaha Panchakopa Trivyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyevacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha.
So we have a continuation of this discussion of states of consciousness, how one is entangled in this material world, identification with the mind, and also more discussion of the three states of consciousness of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, which we've discussed for a couple of days here. And then today this idea of a fourth state of consciousness, Krishna consciousness, is introduced. The Sanskrit word is turye, it says the fourth element. And this other verse that was quoted in 1125, was that today or yesterday? Anyway, also uses this word turye, which is again translated as a fourth state of consciousness. So I don't think we need to become overly concerned with, you know, some strange alternative realities or states of consciousness and fourth dimensions like that. It simply means that beyond material consciousness, there is spiritual consciousness or Krishna consciousness, which is very different from the states of dreaming or wakefulness. Now, the living entity is also described here as being entrapped in material intelligence. I was trying to figure out what exactly being entrapped in material intelligence meant, but I think it's a fairly simple explanation. The word sankshati is used here, which is described as either material intelligence or material existence. And I found a couple places where Prabhupada translated the word sankshati in the Bhagavatam, and he simply translates material existence. And in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura's purport on this verse, he basically calls it samsara. So we're really talking about being entrapped in material existence, samsara, the cycle of birth and death, and of course the material intelligence is very connected with this because it's perceiving the material world in an illusory way. We remember that intelligence, Prabhupada defined as spiritual intelligence, is the ability to discriminate between matter and spirit. And of course, material intelligence is simply how do I thoughtfully figure out how to basically fulfill the desires of the mind and the senses. So the sensory information comes in, the mind processes it, accepts and rejects. The intelligence then is sort of the executor, the execution process. So intelligence is there, and intelligence, which is, you know, materially contaminated, creates and maintains this whole sort of illusory state. And on the other hand, intelligence was purified, will come to the state of this fourth state of consciousness, which is spiritual consciousness. So we've been hearing a lot about waking and dreaming and And these analogies are often used in our Krishna conscious literature and throughout the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita because they're very appropriate and they're something that we can understand and relate to. We all relate to the experience of sleeping and perhaps dreaming, and we know that that's a particular reality, but yet it is not quite consistent with our waking reality. It's a different state of consciousness. It may be real in one sense, but to our waking state, it's not real. And a couple of days ago, Chaitanya Charan Prabhu gave a very nice class completely examining those different states of sleeping, wakefulness, and deep sleep, and what exactly they mean. I was recalling a verse we studied about, oh, it was almost a couple of years ago, in the 10th canto, chapter 54 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where Lord Balaram was preaching the essence of philosophy. I found this interesting. I remember I gave this class, I think, on some of these verses, because we don't really see Balaram being the primary, speaker of, spiritual philosophy. We see him doing some wonderful pastimes. We have, but as far as, he only has a few opportunities where he really gets to expound philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So he does in this particular chapter 54. This is where, this is about Rukmini's grief for her brother Rukma. I forget whether it's when Krishna just basically cut his hair off and humiliated him, or when Balaram, maybe it was when Balaram later killed him. Anyway, Balaram was preaching to Rukmini, trying to get her to understand she shouldn't be attached to Rukma, and that simply this is bodily attachment. Of course, that's sometimes a hard sell when someone just has their brother killed, but still, these are very transcendental personalities, and Rukmini was completely able to understand this, and of course, she's part of the whole pastime. And as we know, she wasn't so fond of her brother compared to, and was obviously wanting Krishna to take her away at that time. Anyway, Balaram explained the difference between the soul and the body, and he used three different analogies. One he used was the sun, as distinct from the sight and the sense objects that are seen, just like the soul is detached and aloof and witnessing the objects of the senses. And then he talked about the moon and the moon phases. And he talked about how the moon appears, and then on the dark moon day it disappears, but yet the moon is still there. So in the same way, the body appears and disappears, we call it birth and death, but yet the soul remains. And so we may not see the soul, but yet it is always there, just like we may not see the moon because whatever the astrological situation is it blocked the earth between the sun and the moon, and therefore we don't see it, whatever it is. In that way, it's only an illusion that the soul is not there, and the body is going through different transformations, just like moon phases. And then the third example he gives is more appropriate to what we've been talking about the last couple of days. He talks about the sleeping person in a dream, and how the person that dream is different from the experience. So when we're in a dream, it's very real to us. But when we wake up, we understand it's not real, it's illusory. But it was very real in that dream state to us. And sometimes if we have a very vivid dream, the memory of it continues even when we're awake. Usually we forget most of our dreams. But if they're very, very salient, very significant, perhaps a nightmare or something like that, they're really in our consciousness, and we have some trace memory of that after we awake. So in the same way, the soul has this, memory, and the Prabhupada kind of explained it like that. He says when we go back to the spiritual world, he says our memory of the material world is kind of like a bad dream. That's right. I had some experience here in the material world. It wasn't very nice. Let me just stay here in the spiritual world with Krishna. So that continues. But when we're attached to sense gratification, this body and this material world, the body illusion continues. So even though we are the pure spirit soul, that illusion is very strong to us. And it remains, it's just kind of like we have that vivid memory of the dream. In the same way, it's even more vivid. Our waking state of identification as bodies and senses is very, very strong. In that particular verse in chapter 54, the 10th canto, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments on this. He says, though bondage in samsara is based on illusion, it's okay, we all know that, it's illusion. He says, the suffering it induces does not go away. So it's very strong. Though things related to imposition by false identity have factual existence, the suffering arising from the relationship with samsara does not disappear. It does not disappear for a jiva who meditates on sense objects with intelligence directed at enjoying. So in other words, it's a very, very strong and very real thing for us. And the illusion of the bodily senses and bodily mind is not so easy to break. I think obviously it's a central point of Krishna consciousness we've discussed many times in these Bhagavatam classes. When you think about it, a dead body has no sensation, right? There's no consciousness, nothing's happening. It is only the appearance of the soul, or it is only the soul within the body that enlivens the body, enlivens the senses, the symptoms of life are there, and consciousness is there. Without the soul, there'd be no consciousness in the body, and there would also be no sensation. So, in other words, there is a connection between the soul and the sensations that our bodily senses are experiencing with the objects of senses. So it's not that it's unreal. There is something really happening, and the soul's consciousness is experiencing that. So how is it illusory? It's illusory because at that point, we are identifying, the consciousness is identifying with something that is temporary, that is not our real state. Our real state is Krishna consciousness, to be completely in our relationship with Krishna, to be serving Krishna, and to have very little to do with this material world. You know, but because the soul is within this body and the senses are so strong and the impressions on the mind from lifetimes are so strong, we tend to identify very, very much with these. So it's a natural thing to identify in this material world with our sensory experience. And so because these things are so strong, it influences our identity, our sense of who we are. And this is a central point of Krishna consciousness. What is our real identity? Our real identity, of course, is eternal servant of Krishna. But while we're in this material world, that identity changes. It becomes covered. The consciousness becomes covered by our interrelationship with material energy, the modes of nature, the sense objects, the mind. So we tend to believe that the things that I am currently experiencing, what I like, what are my tastes, my beliefs, my preferences, even my material personality, we think these things are us. This is who I am. And even as devotees, it's difficult to not think that all the time. And we may theoretically think, yeah, I know this isn't really me, but yet it remains very strong. We have experience, even like with counseling or therapy, that behavioral change is difficult for people. It's hard for people to change their behaviors, but they can. It can be done. We've all experienced that. Before we were devotees, we probably had all sorts of bad habits, and after becoming devotees, we gave up many of those things. So we can change our behavior, particularly through spiritual knowledge and spiritual practice. But it's much more difficult to change the personality, isn't it? Personality is very embedded, and the fundamental personality generally doesn't change so much. We probably have experienced that, mentioned this before, that well, before we came to Krishna consciousness, we had a certain personality. You might have been introverted or extroverted, or you may have had whatever it might be. You might have been an anxious kind of person, a very relaxed kind of person. And after you became a devotee, I suspect those basic things, your personality, didn't change a lot. In other words, your beliefs change, your actions change, your behaviors change, the way you view the world, your philosophy. All that may have changed, but we still are sort of the person that is there. Now, I've often thought about this. Is there a connection between the spirit soul, the spiritual personality in our spiritual body, and what manifests here in the material world as our material personality? I'd say probably not so much, unless we're very purified. And when one becomes very pure, there's little distinction between the spiritual personality and material personality, because the person is completely completely Krishna conscious. And that spirit, and that the real person, the spirit soul, is coming out and emanating more and more. And that doesn't mean that all spiritual personalities are the same, right? We don't have this generic, here's what a pure devotee looks like. Think about Srila Prabhupada and think about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Very different personalities, right? you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I mean, from what we know of them and the stories and the pastimes and biographies, you can see they're very different in many ways, although that pure spiritual personality is manifest, you know, in that they are 100% serving Krishna, preaching Krishna consciousness, you know, completely devoted, you know, to the service of the Lord. So for us, it takes a little longer. It's a little more difficult for the person, material personality to change. But that's something that does happen through purification. And I think it's something we consciously need to be aware of. You know, because I like this and don't like that doesn't mean that's some sort of, you know, like my eternal rasa or something. You know, it's mainly my material conditioning in this lifetime and the particular propensities, the particular modes of nature that I'm associating with. So the issue is identification, and that's what we've been hearing in these verses, in this chapter. False identification is the problem. The pure spirit soul is never contaminated, but through illusion, the consciousness becomes contaminated. The soul is not contaminated, but consciousness, our immediate awareness and thought processes and everything that is in our mind and intelligence, that identifies with matter. It identifies with the senses, identifies with the mind. But when one is in pure consciousness, Krishna consciousness, or as described here, in the fourth state of consciousness, in that fourth state, the identification is with the pure spirit soul, with Krishna, and one understands the temporary nature of this material world, the material body. I was thinking of other examples that we have in our scriptures about how strong this identification is with the body, and this is one I'm sure I've mentioned before. This is an interesting commentary. It's Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, and it's his commentary in the Bhaktivinoda Sindhu 1.1.11, the famous Anyabhilashita Shunyam verse. So, of course, there's about, in the Bhaktivinoda Sindhu, there's about 20 pages of commentaries by Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, because it's such an important verse. It's the most fundamental verse explaining what bhakti yoga is. So in one part where the acharyas are breaking this down, like word by word, syllable by syllable, Vishwanath says, the phrase anyabhilashita shunyam has been chosen. This means devoid of other desire, which are, and this is the important part, deep-rooted as one's nature. It says, in a death-threatening situation, a devotee may say, O Lord, please save me, your devotee, now from this danger, because it's a sudden, temporary desire, but it's not harmful to bhakti. That's because this desire arises beyond his control, opposite of his devotional nature. That desire is not his nature. So in other words, for an advanced devotee, our nature would be simply to serve Krishna, not be so concerned with whatever happens to his material body, like Prahlad Maharaj, you know, whatever happens, I just chant Hare Krishna. But because we so strongly, even as devotees and even very advanced devotees, identify with the body, it's natural, like in a state of danger, a state of emergency, that one might think, oh, Krishna saved me. You know, and that's not so bad. And in fact, Krishna is saying that's perfectly normal. I mean, it's normal to sort of like, in other words, try to preserve the body we're in. We eat, we sleep, we do things to take care of this body, because this body is our temple. And it's our vehicle for devotional service while we're in this material world. So, you know, to want to save the body is a fairly natural desire, and it's basically harmless. But at the same time, it illustrates that even advanced devotee, we tend to naturally identify with this body very strongly. So that takes a lot of years of devotional service to overcome that identification. And what's the problem with that? The problem is, of course, it brings about all types of unhappiness and distress, what to speak of continued birth and death in this material world. So we do want to get out of this bodily conception, because identifying with the material body basically sets us up for suffering. The Srimad Bhagavatam 10.20.42, that's the chapter of about Vrindavan in autumn, says, the autumn moon relieved all creatures of the suffering caused by the sun's rays, just as wisdom relieves a person of the misery caused by his identifying with this material body. So that's our source of suffering, identification with the body, the mind, the senses. So, our best process, alleviating suffering is understanding the process of bhakti yoga. It's described that we are suffering, we experience that. Why do we suffer? Suffering is called klesha. Beyond that is the bija, the seed of suffering, which means the material desires which promote suffering. And why do we have those desires? Because of avidya, ignorance. So bhakti is the process that destroys klesha, bija, and avidya. In other words, it goes all the way back to the ignorance, which means identification with the body, that causes that suffering. So all knowledge, renunciation, come about through bhakti. Bhagavatam says, Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Priyojita Janat Yashu Vairagyam Gyanam Yachadyara Haitukam. By rendering devotional service unto the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, one immediately acquires causeless knowledge and detachment from this world. So these things have come about as byproducts of the process of hearing and chanting of bhakti. That knowledge which destroys ignorance, which destroys suffering, which destroys the identification of the body and the senses, comes about, I don't want to say automatically, but it says causeless, causeless detachment, comes about through the process of bhakti. So Krishna consciousness is not a negative denial. Our process isn't, you know, I have to somehow with some great austerity restrain the senses completely, but it's a positive use of the material and therefore spiritualizing the senses, the mind, the body through engagement in devotional service. Srila Prabhupada explains this in a purport, 325.7 Bhagavatam. Prabhupada says, we should know that beyond these temporary senses are our permanent senses, which are now covered by the material body. The permanent senses, being contaminated by matter, are not acting properly. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Our senses, just they're not acting properly. Devotional service, therefore, involves freeing the senses from this contamination. When the contamination is completely removed and the senses act in the purity of unalloyed Krishna consciousness, we have reached satindriya, or eternal sensory activities. Sat eternal. So the senses have an eternal identity, an eternal occupation. Eternal sensory activities are called devotional service, whereas temporary sensory activities are called sense gratification. So we always hear about sense gratification versus devotional service. This is an interesting perspective the Prabhupada gives us. It's about sense activities. We have temporary sense activities, sensory engagement in this material world, and the spiritual world, we have our eternal sensory engagement. So we're not stopping the senses from acting. We're reactivating, re-enlivening the spiritual senses, which are down there somewhere rather deeply. But our coming out, as Prabhupada said, the mirror of the mind, you know, the dust on the mirror of the mind is cleared by the process of bhakti. So also in the Narada Pancharatna, quoted many places in our scriptures, Sarvopadi Vinirmuktam Tatparadvena Nirmalam Hrishikena Hrishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchite. Bhakti or devotional service means engaging all of our senses in the service of the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master of all senses. When the spirit soul renders service unto the Supreme, there are two side effects. Okay, here's what happens. One, we're freed from all material designations. And two, one's senses are purified simply by being employed in the service of the Lord. So once again, confirmed in all of our scriptures that the way of purification of the senses and the mind is through devotional service. So we have a very positive, a very hopeful understanding of the nature of the soul, the nature of who we are, the nature of life. Yes, we're a little bit negative about the material world. The Prabhupada said we should be materially pessimistic, but spiritually optimistic. So in other words, we understand that when one revives one's dormant Krishna consciousness, then it's a very, very joyful experience. In the Bhagavad Gita, verse 1334 says, O son of Bharata, as the sun alone illuminates all of this universe, so does the living entity, one within the body, illuminate the entire body by consciousness. So the soul is illumining the body when we reach this fourth state of consciousness. And what's that symptom of illumination? 1854 says, Brahmabhuta Prasanatma, one who knows the self is always joyful, is happy. So that's the true nature of our self, that we are joyful, happy in our relationship with Krishna. So the real study of the self is to understand the spirit soul and our eternal nature, the soul's position, which is servant of Krishna. So we have a very, very nice process of reviving that original spiritual nature, of reactivating the spiritual senses within the body through the chanting of the holy name. In the Bhagavatam 6.3.24, Yamaraj says, therefore, it should be understood that one is easily relieved of all sinful reactions by chanting the holy name of the Lord and the chanting of his qualities and activities. This is the only process recommended for relief from sinful reaction. Even if one chants the holy name of the Lord with improper pronunciation, he will achieve relief from material bondage if he chants without offense. So, of course, the whole story of Ajamil and the first three chapters of sixth canto are very, very wonderful, which really explain the glories of the holy name and the power of the holy name to relieve us of all sinful activities. Padma Purana says, the name of the Lord fulfills all desires like chintanami. So not only does it free us from sinful activity, but it also gives us a very, very positive experience, a very joyful experience. The name of the Lord fulfills all desires like chintanami. It is the very form of Krishna. It is full of consciousness and rasa. It is complete, pure, and eternally liberated. This is because of the non-difference of the name and Krishna. That's found in Bhakti Samriti Sindhu 1.2.233. So devotees see chanting as service. And chanting is a call to Krishna. Please engage me in your devotional service. O Krishna, O Radharani, please engage me in your service. So now we have this wonderful month of Kartik, which I think is probably one of the favorite times of the year for many devotees, if not most devotees. There's something so special about it and so sweet in the pastimes of Damodar and Mother Yashoda. And there's just something very magical I always find about the chanting of Damodarastakam and the ghee lamps and all of that. I don't know what it is. It must be some spiritual thing that I'm slightly comprehending, you know, in some way. Because it's just an ecstatic, wonderful spiritual experience. So sometimes, of course, we say Kartik Vrata, and Prabhupada uses this word Kartik Vrata. Vrata, of course, means some renunciation, some vow. Yeah. Now, it's interesting. Srila Prabhupada, in his time with us, actually did not give us a lot of vratas. Prabhupada was very, very merciful, and he gave us very, very basic things. Like Ekadasi said, don't eat beans and grains. And Kartik, he said, this month what, we don't eat urdal, right? And it's explained because it's very high protein, it's, you know, considered almost like non-vegetarian. I mean, not that we normally eat it, but in Kartik we don't. And there's some other things like that. And there's one description, I was looking this up today, I'd never seen this before. He gives a long description of how you draw mandalas and clay and colors in front of the temple. Kartik, you know, but Prabhupada didn't give us a lot of elaborate rituals and a lot of elaborate vratas. But what he mainly always stressed in holy days, festival days, Ekadasi, special months, was increase our hearing and chanting, increase our devotional service. So it is a wonderful opportunity to try to, and I noticed in Mangalartik today we had a very, you know, full house, and here at the temple, you know, many, many people come. So people are increasing. They're hearing and chanting, coming to the temple and things like that. So that's very, very nice. And we gain special benefit when we do that. I mean, we always gain benefit from hearing and chanting. We always gain benefit from coming to the temple. But during Kartik, you get a little extra, you know, a little extra mercy. So again, a good time to increase our chanting, which is the process of spiritual life in this age of Kali. I'll finish with another nice quote from Srila Prabhupada about chanting from Madhya Lila 22.16. Srila Prabhupada says, when we chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, we are saying, Hare, O energy of the Lord, O my Lord Krishna. In this way, we are simply addressing the Lord and His spiritual potency. The devotee always prays to the Lord and his internal energy so that he may engage in their transcendental loving service. When the conditioned soul attains his real spiritual energy and fully surrenders unto the lotus feet of the Lord, he tries to engage in the Lord's service. This is the real constitutional position of the living entity. Jai Srila Prabhupada. So, are there comments, questions, Ubendra?
I just wanted to share some thoughts about Kartik. It says, any small service to the Lord in Kartik will give multiplied benefits. The result of donating, the result of one obtained by giving 10,000 cows in charity can be obtained by offering only one tulsi leaf to the Supreme Lord during the month of Kartik. If somebody performs even a little worship of Lord Sri Hari in this month, he offers that devotee his own abode. If somebody burns a lamp in the temple of Lord Sri Hari, even for a short time in the month of Kartik, then whatever sins he has acquired for millions of kalpas, one kalpa equals 1,000 yugas, are all destroyed. A person who happily reads the Bhagavad Gita in the month of Kartik does not return to the world of birth and death. Of all gifts, the gift of a lamp during the month of Kartik is the best. No gift is its equal. The pious result obtained by bathing in all holy places and giving all charities is not equal to 1/10,000,000th part of the result obtained by following the vow of Kartik.
Yeah, where is that from?
Haribo. Somebody just shared with me. I don't know.
Oh, you don't have a source? That's very wonderful. Again, everything we do is so much increased on these special times and times like Kartik. And the mention of the lamp was there several times. So, of course, we do that. But remember, only one lamp. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Oh, yes? Richie.
You mentioned that... Hare Krishna. Prabhu, you mentioned that the deeper parts of our personality, our material conditioning, are harder to change than our behavior and other things. So what I'm wondering is, if one has material desires and is conscious that they're coming, that they're there due to misidentification with the, and you know, conditioning coming from many lifetimes, so one's aware of that, but is unable to actually give up those desires because the conditioning is so deep, then what's the best way of dealing with that?
Yeah, excellent question. And it's kind of like, that's our dilemma, isn't it? I mean, you basically spelled out what is our issue as devotees in this material world. How do we give up all those deep-seated desires that may have been there for lifetimes? And they're very entrenched, you know, in our mind, our senses, our personality structure. Well, I guess one thing is there's sort of a baseline in terms of material desires. We have like the four regular principles. Things say, in other words, those things are so counterproductive to spiritual life that we do need to, you know, control some of our material desires. But then beyond that, it's really the more positive process of hearing and chanting, a purification of those desires that comes about through bhakti yoga. You know, through our sadhana bhakti, that's what we're really doing. We're purifying the heart of all of those anartas and attachments from past lifetimes. And it's just a gradual process. But if we were situated properly, following the orders of the spiritual master, then we are generally going to be going forward. I mean, sometimes it feels a little up and down, you know, but the general progress will be upward, you know, that we become more detached from material, more attached to Krishna, as long as we are performing the basic processes of sadhana. Yeah. I mean, it seems difficult, but it's really a fairly simple process, I think. You know, but it's the execution that's difficult. Yeah. But thank you. Okay. Was there anything else, sir? No. Okay, Jai, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.